Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a program that explores the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host, Greta Anderson, and today's topic is local produce. Thanks to a burgeoning fresh foods movement, we know some of the benefits of sourcing our food close to home. We know that fresh-picked food is healthier for us, and that buying local is better for our local economy. But you might ask, how did we get into a situation where we had to make a conscious effort to eat local? For our not-so-distant ancestors, all food was local. In this show, we'll look at the forces of transportation, both rail and by truck. We'll look at grocery stores in Ames and how they have changed, and at the history of farmers' market here. And we'll look at the new model of community-supported agriculture, or CSAs, where it came from and how it was adopted in Story County. Finally, we'll talk to some happy customers of the local food movement. Stay tuned for all of that. Americans began getting out-of-season fruits and vegetables from as far away as Florida and California by the late 1800s. Typically, they would travel in ventilated boxcars, then arrive at regional trackside warehouses for smaller groceries to distribute. This situation lasted until more recent decades, when refrigerated trucks and the interstate highways also began to play a role. A little linguistic history will show us how very linked are the destinies of vegetables and trucks. The word truck originally meant commerce. This, of course, was long before the internal combustion engine was even a glimmer in someone's eye. Then, round about the 19th century, a specialized meaning of the word cropped up. Truck began to be used as a synonym for wholesale vegetables. What does that tell you? For our purposes, let's suffice it to say that there's not much truck that's more important than vegetable truck. With all this in mind, I went next door to the Ames Historical Society to see what I could find out about how Ames residents got their food and vegetables in the past. As always happens when I enter their door, I walked into a gold mine. I'm over here at Ames Historical Society with research assistant Margaret Vance, who helped in putting together a very interesting display about grocery shopping in Ames. Margaret, there are three panels. Could you describe for the audience what these three panels are about?
Well, they're chronological. The first one is very early Ames, back when groceries were all on Main Street. The second one is the mom-and-pop era, which were little grocery stores located in different areas around town. And then the third one is the supermarkets.
And in the earlier period, you've noted that at first the food stores were small and more specialized. Meat markets, bakeries, dry goods stores, and produce stores all existed separately, kind of like you might find in Europe?
I think that's probably a good comparison. And there were many of them. In the first two blocks on Main Street at one time, there were 10 different food-related shops.
That's quite something. I'm looking at a picture of Spence Fruit and Produce from 1910, and in the window, you can see they're advertising Cuban pineapples. This was before the Communist Revolution, so why not? Then in the mom-and-pop era, you really get to see how people were eating, because they have advertisements for each separate grocery with items listed. And you can tell that a lot of the food was frozen, a lot of the food was canned, and then there were a few fresh produce items, just a few. So, for instance, you have the spinach and cut corn came frozen at Campus Grocery, and this was what era?
1941.
And then it says Del Monte number 2, Del Monte 2.5, and that refers to what?
That would be the can size.
Those are green lima beans, spinach, pumpkin, green beans. They also have cherries, pitted cherries in a can. And then in the fresh fruits section, we have all the tropical fruits, grapefruit, oranges, bananas, and lemons. So those were available. How do you suppose they came in?
I suppose it came by rail because that's what would be available. And more than likely, they would not be year-round like we would have things today. They would be what was in season were in the location where they were grown.
And then the other fresh produce items are?
Head lettuce, cabbage, onions, parsnips, and potatoes. And most of those would survive quite well for a length of time for the travel that they might require or for storage.
So it appears that people were really eating very well because you don't see much advertisement for junk food at all. It's all good food, but it comes in cans and it comes in frozen packages.
I think the prices are interesting to see in the ads as well. You could buy two heads of lettuce for 13 cents. A head of cabbage was only 3 cents.
So, yeah, there were 10. You've listed 10 neighborhood groceries back in 1940.
And some of them were very tiny, like this Vans grocery that was on Lincoln Way across from Harris TV, where they are today. That was just a tiny little store, and then the owners and managers lived in the house that was behind it. And then you compare that with the 9th Street grocery, which was known as Melander's Market. It was associated with the Jack Spratt chain.
So there were some chains coming in at this time.
There were.
The most famous neighborhood grocery, though, is probably Abe's.
Ames Fruit and Grocery. That was its real name, but everyone called it Abe's. It was owned by Abe Mizvinsky. And the first one was located at 2nd and Elm, kind of off the beaten path, but people found it. He did very well, and he ended up with two other stores. The last one was on 24th Street, which is now Ace Hardware in that building. Abe built that building for his third grocery store.
That's interesting. The Chipman's Grocery ad shows two items, frozen limas and broccoli, and then fresh asparagus. So it must have been that the asparagus was in season.
I'm guessing that was a spring ad. Chipman's was a tiny little grocery store. The building still stands today on 9th Street. It's that wedge-shaped building near Roosevelt School.
And eventually, in the 1950s, we got to stores that were called mega stores.
And many people might remember the day when grocery stores gave trading stamps. S&H green stamps were very popular, and then there were others. Regal, we have some Regal ones on our display. But you got a certain number of stamps per dollar that you spent, and then you could trade them in on merchandise that they had available. And that was a big thing all across the country at one period of time.
Okay, well, thank you, Margaret. This is a really great display. People should come in and check it out.
Oh, thank you very much.
Where do vegetables and fruit come from? They come from the grocery store. As we have seen, there's a bit of truth to that. This is Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio, and we're exploring the delivery chain for fruits and vegetables. Next, we are going to talk to Tom Sveck, who grew up in Ames and in the late 60s through 1971 served as an all-purpose grocery worker at Ames Fruit and Grocery. That was a grocery store or chain of grocery stores that was owned by the legendary Abe Mizvinsky. Hi, Tom.
Hello, Greta.
So you were working at a place called Ames Fruit and Grocery. How much fruit did you guys sell?
Well, I think in those days, typically a grocery store was divided into three, you know, money-generating entities. There was the meat market, the general grocery, and then produce. So produce was often, and I think in the case of Ames Fruit and Grocery, there was a produce manager, you know, whose paycheck depended on the selling of fresh fruits and vegetables.
Okay, so what kind of fresh fruits and vegetables were available?
Iowa and the upper Midwest was not a produce-producing state, or at least Iowa wasn't, central Iowa wasn't. So a lot of the produce that I saw coming in and out of Ames Fruit and Grocery came through wholesale grocers in Des Moines, down in the flats along the Des Moines River where there used to be extensive rail yards. There were a number of wholesalers who brought in carload quantities of fresh produce from areas that did grow produce. Most of that produce, the boxes and so on, bore the labels of producers that were almost all out of state. As anybody who grew up in Central Iowa would know, the produce of that era was pretty much limited to its typical growing season. I do remember some local sweet corn, but it wasn't a long season. I do remember the sort of almost legendary melons from Muscatine, Iowa, cantaloupes. People waited for those to come into season, and generally speaking, they were cream of the crop, much superior to those that were trucked or railroaded in from Florida or elsewhere. The other event, and I think one of the things that I would characterize in terms of the supply of fresh produce, is that they were sort of events. Strawberries came in. There probably were some local strawberries, but again, it was an event. They came in a fairly short window, and when they were gone, they were gone. And I do remember Missouri peaches, and again, they were often anticipated by people who canned peaches. They were often sold by the lug, and again, they were anticipated, and the window was fairly small.
So during the winter months, was the produce department of Ames Fruit and Grocery pretty bare?
It was. It was very basic. Typically in the wintertime, you would get apples from Washington State. They were, in those days, Red Delicious and maybe some Golden Delicious. Citrus crops from Florida and California. Lettuce all came from the Central Valley in California. Iceberg lettuce was pretty much the lettuce. If you went to the store for lettuce, that's what you were looking for.
So how did folks in Central Iowa get their vegetables?
Well, I know that in our neighborhood there were still people who gardened. I think there was probably from Victory Gardens during World War II, there was a carryover of backyard gardening activity. Canned vegetables were a whole different story. One of my memories of canned vegetables was the Owatonna, Minnesota, which was home of Festal Farms, F-E-S-T-A-L Farms. And that was a big supplier of canned corn, canned beans, and canned peas. And I think from watching the volume of canned vegetables and fruits that went out of the grocery store in those days, that constituted much of, quote, fresh fruit and vegetables in the wintertime in Central Iowa.
Okay, so you were unloading those boxcars.
We did, on several occasions, unload boxcars in late August on a siding somewhere between Main Street and Lincoln Way and Clark and Duff Avenue. I doubt that any of those sidings are still there, but I remember going down and opening the seal on a boxcar. And I think you see them going by in Ames on the Union Pacific track. And it's almost a cliche, but you have no idea how much a boxcar holds until you have to empty it.
And what about refrigerated trucks? Did you unload those as well?
Yes. Typically, there were the Ames Fruit and Grocery System owned several refrigerated trucks that would bring produce up from Des Moines. A lot of it was, you know, the local produce was often delivered. The aforementioned Muscatine melons, oftentimes I saw either farmers or brokers for farmers that would drive up with trucks, sometimes tractor trailers with nothing but Muscatine melons in them. Huh. There were also truckers that came up from Texas and Arkansas with watermelons in the summer. I remember unloading semi-trucks full of watermelons that were probably half the size that I was.
Well, I'm sure it made you a little bigger doing that.
Well, it never succeeded hugely, but yes, it was a job that involved a fair amount of muscle, because all of the freight, canned goods, fresh fruit, all that stuff was all handled by hand in the Ames Fruit and Grocery system. No pallet jacks or forklifts or any of that kind of stuff.
I see.
In that particular system.
I see. Well, congratulations on working your way out of that job.
It was great incentive to go to college.
Okay. Well, Tom, I'm going to sign off now, and thank you very much for contributing to our show.
Take care.
That was Tom Speck, now in Pennsylvania, talking about the role he played in the food distribution chain. This is Local Talk, and we're now going to turn to a couple of long-term fruit and vegetable growers in Story County. About the time that Tom was stocking Abe's Grocery with what we might consider a pitiful supply of fruits and vegetables, the first Ames Farmers Market was being organized. Judy Henry of Berry Patch Farm was there in 1968. We hear from her, then we turn to Bruce Smith from north of Jewell, who has been growing produce since the 1980s and selling produce for even longer. I'm here with Judy Henry of Berry Patch Farm. The Henrys have been doing market gardening for a long time. They bought this farm in 1970, so they've been out here for 43 years, but they were farming even before that and were among the first people to be involved in Ames Farmers Market when it got started in 1968. Judy, can you tell me that story about the beginnings of the farmers market as best as you can recall?
I will. I remember just a few names, but Veronica Rudenberg, who had lived in Europe, was here in Ames and would like to get a farmers market started, she thought. She and a friend, the friend had a child enrolled in my preschool, decided that they would meet and try to start one market in Ames to attract a lot of visitors and vendors. People became quite interested and were willing to join the group, and then they decided that the railroad depot west end of Main Street would be a good location for each Saturday morning.
So at the first time it was held out there in the train depot, about how many vendors do you think were there that first year?
I think we had close to a dozen people, and some of those people are still vending. We had Dick Martin, and I believe he still likes to vend his melons and vegetables, and Dick and Letha DeMoss, and we had Polly and Greg Reinhardt, and we had Dale Halbrick. He's since moved out of Iowa, but several who stayed on and kept on with their gardening.
And what were you growing at the time, and where?
Well, we had rented some ground north of Ames at General Filter, across from Ada Hayden Park, and we had a 3-year lease on a little plot of ground that we planted strawberries in by hand. That was the last time we ever did it, by hand. And then we found this farm here.
So you always knew that it was strawberries for you.
That was our really first love, and we thought that would attract people to come, and we could have pick your own and or picked and then take some to market as well.
So the market stayed at the train depot for quite a long time. Was that a nice place to sell?
Well, we liked it for its historical value and just for the fact that the trains came and went, although I can remember trying to make a transaction when it was noisy with a train there. It wasn't ideal, but it did draw people. And we soon outgrew it, actually.
There wasn't a lot of construction to begin with, and then the construction sort of moved in. The Hy-Vee that we know there was not there then, and some of the other buildings that are in that lot were not there. And at that point, you moved to the North Grand Mall, is that right?
We did, and the lot west of J.C. Penney's was chosen, and we also thought we'd have a midweek market, so we chose Wednesday and added that to our market days.
Do you know where the people who were growing for the first market sold their stuff before there was a farmer's market?
Well, I think several had little spots in their hometowns, or people would come directly to their farm. And some did not really put out a lot of vegetables, fruit, or baked goods or crafts until they really had a good market. So I think it was just a growing idea for them, and then as they had the weekly market, they could increase their sales.
And over the years, what have been some of the challenges that have faced the farmers market? At some point, there were three farmers markets in Ames. How did all that come about?
Well, not everyone sees eye to eye on several rules, and so the group would split here and there. It all came down to who is willing to work with who and how does it all work out to be the best for the customers who come to the market. So now we have two markets in Ames in May for quite a while. I, for one, was always glad that we had people that were committed to coming to our Ames market no matter what, the weather, the season, and they would just be there every time. There were some that would come and go and maybe give up after a year or two, but there were some that stayed and stayed and stayed, and that's what it takes. You have to have commitment to keep markets going. And because of the Buy Local, Buy Fresh campaign, that has really spurred people to visit the markets and know where their food comes from. It's been a big help.
So your farm has been growing and changing at the same time. You started with strawberries and then also apple trees.
Right, and then people would say, well, why don't you have any raspberries, or did you ever try cherries? And little by little, they would ask for some different type of fruit, and we would think, well, let's just put out a sample, and so we would do that and see how that worked, and it seemed to grow into an idea that, well, why do we have strawberries in June and apples in September when we could have people here in July and August all the way through the summer? So what grows through the summer? Raspberries, blackberries, gooseberries, currants. So we thought, well, we'll just put a few of those kinds of things in and see what happens. And that worked well for us.
And in the last couple years, you've done a major entrepreneurial venture with your hoop house. Tell me about that decision.
Well, it was to extend the seasons, and if we would have a hoop house, a greenhouse, something heated, what could we do with that? We could have more salad greens, we could try some strawberries in there, some cucumbers, some squash. We liked the challenge of what could be done. We'd always wanted to try it, and we thought, well, we're not getting any younger, let's try it. So we did, and we now have five greenhouses, and they're all full and working well, and we do heat with our own wood from the farm here with one of them. We were able to hire a farm manager that had knowledge of different things and how to grow in the hoop house, and that worked out well for us too. Right now there's tomatoes that are all set on, and the vines are about 4 to 5 foot tall, and it's just full of strawberry baskets and squash and zucchini, and I'm thinking, look at all this good stuff that's away from the weather and the elements, and you can count on it. It's good.
And I was visiting with the cafe, and they were so thrilled that they could serve lettuce year-round from your hoop house.
They've been a great customer for us, and they always ask what's coming, and they try to adjust their menus to suit what's in season, which is ideal, and we're very thankful for them and for the CSA that we have from Ames, too.
The Farm to Folk CSA, is that what you're referring to?
Right. The Farm to Folk, and Marilyn Anderson heads that up, and she was originally the person, I believe, who started with the Beanstalk. And she kept helping and working on that, and she's been very faithful and keeps that whole CSA going very well.
It's very nice. I love your spirit of adventure. It's great to see that that can last throughout a marriage and a career.
Well, I think you have to keep going if you're going to be involved, or you'll just quit. And so having a challenge of the greenhouses and with our newest crop, the blueberries, it's really been a good time for us to stay involved, I think, at our age.
Well, thanks a lot, Judy. I wish you very well on your season, and it's always a pleasure to come out here and see you.
Well, thank you, and I think I want to encourage people to support their local market and get to know the vendors and help them out. It's a great encouragement when you say, thanks for coming. This was a cold, windy day, or this was a wet day, but thanks for coming, because we put a lot of effort into every market.
That was Judy Henry of Berry Patch Farm. Later in the show, we'll talk with Marilyn Anderson, who Judy praised for her faithfulness to the concept of local fruits and vegetables. Now let's turn to another long-term grower, Bruce Smith, who I caught up with at the end of the Saturday morning farmer's market. Bruce Smith, Iowa Farm Produce. It's the end of the farmer's market day here in Ames downtown. How long have you been growing?
Oh, we started in about 1984, I believe. Originally, I was working in produce departments at grocery stores, and then an opportunity came from one of the fellows I was buying from. He was looking to expand, so I went and worked with him for about 4 years, and then he's moved on, and so we just kind of took over from there.
Was that Dale Halbrick?
Oh, yes, it was. In fact, Dale's out in Long Island now, out in New York, and he's still gardening out there. So, and I don't know if he was always going to write a book. I don't know if he ever got that accomplished, but I know he's doing his gardening. So,
yes, I understand he was quite the luminary in the history of Ames Local Foods.
Yeah, he had some innovative ideas, and he was... Well, to coin a phrase I heard this morning here, he was local before local was cool. So he was one of the first to start with the truck farming back when there was only a few markets here throughout Iowa.
So you had the experience of being a produce manager, getting your vegetables from afar as well as nearby. And what was that like?
Well, it was probably what led me on the course to growing myself, because I really enjoyed the produce industry, because it's something's always changing. Something's coming on or something's going out. Something's new. There's fads that come and go, and people are always wanting to know how to deal with certain vegetables, and I always kind of like talking about that type of thing. So,
where did you get your vegetables from besides Dale Halbrick?
That was in the late 70s when we got them from Dale at Fairway. And other than that, there was just a couple different growers that were probably in their late 50s back then that brought it. And otherwise, it was all shipped in from California or Mexico. So it was all trucked in, basically, anyway.
Okay. Well, it's getting kind of noisy around here. People are closing up shop, and I don't want to detain you any longer, but thank you so much, Bruce.
Thank you. We'll see ya.
This is Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio. I'm your host, Greta Anderson. The grower Bruce mentioned, Dale Halbrick, provided inspiration for a generation of vegetable growers in Story County. Not only was Dale local before local was cool, he was more or less organic before anyone valued that idea either. According to my husband, Mark Harris, who worked for Dale 2 years in the early 1980s, Dale's real success was organizational.
Well, Dale was a remarkable person in that he was very successful at market gardening. Dale was an incredibly industrious person. I mean, there were days in August that he easily worked 20 hours a day harvesting and delivering vegetables. He had transplants going all the time, and he was able to get 2 or 3 seasons out of every growing season because of his extreme planting skills. But it's one thing to grow vegetables. It's another thing to sell them. And Dale was very persistent on selling to restaurants, selling to grocery stores. And those are maybe even harder than selling to the farmers market, because retailers like restaurants and grocery stores want consistency. They want consistency in delivery. In other words, they don't want you to just show up one time. They want you to show up day after day for the length of the season with quality product. And that's what Dale was able to do year after year, season after season.
Did Dale invest in a lot of technologies, or did he do this just by hard scrabble work?
Dale invested in technologies that were necessary. In other words, a refrigeration system, so that you could harvest the product when it was mature and keep it fresh until you could deliver it to market. He designed his own transplanter using a modified corn planter, just a two-row corn planter that was very simple, but the fact is he could plant with two other people, putting the plants in the ground just hundreds and hundreds of feet in just an hour or two because of his design for this simple transplanter. We would actually sit behind where the seed bucket used to be, and we'd sit there and we would take the transplant off a tray and stick it in the furrow, and then it would basically cover up the transplant and pack it down. You can see him out there in the market, but yeah, he created something that made it much more efficient to transplant, just using old equipment, really. I mean, he did drip irrigation, which, I think was fairly new around here for sure. In other words, how are you going to water all these plants when they need the water and in the most efficient way? And so you have a tube that has little holes and it just drips the water right at the plant very slowly but thoroughly. Dale practiced what we would call organic gardening. All his inputs were principally labor. We did a lot of weeding, by hand. And again, he was a farmer, so he knew how to cultivate. So he'd rigged up some cultivators behind his tractor so he could do weed cultivation. So, I mean, he was very, very efficient at keeping his garden weed-free without chemicals. The other thing he did that really made it possible is he built his own greenhouse on the south side of his house. And that's where he was able to start and mature all his transplants, tens of thousands of transplants. I mean, it was just unbelievable, his production.
You were definitely inspired by him then.
I was inspired by Dale. Admittedly, I was inspired by the fact that he was financially successful. But I learned a lot when I tried to market garden about how challenging the planning and being consistent and marketing really is. And, that was the genius of Dale. It was, I think, those things.
My husband Mark was also the first grower for what was the Ames area's first CSA, the Magic Beanstalk. CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture. It was a new model for vegetable growing, whereby the customer signed up before the season started for a share of farm produce. I asked Mark what he remembers about being approached to grow for the Magic Beanstalk.
I know that there was a group organizing for CSA, and I think that organization was started by Robert Karp. And my son's mother, Kim McDermott, was on that committee, and I'm guessing she might have recommended me. Robert moved to Ames from Western Massachusetts, and he belonged to a CSA out there. And coincidentally, my aunts lived in Western Massachusetts and belonged to the same CSA. So prior to starting growing for the CSA, I went and visited my aunts, and they took me over to visit that CSA, so I got to spend an afternoon visiting with the principal grower at the CSA in Western Massachusetts and learning more about the philosophy and the ups and downs of being in a CSA. I was excited about it for the various reasons that CSAs exist, and I was glad for the opportunity.
As it turns out, the Western Massachusetts CSA that Robert Karp belonged to and the CSA that Mark visited is credited with bringing the idea of the CSA to America's shores. I talk now with Elizabeth Keene, the current operator and owner of Indian Line Farm in Western Massachusetts.
I think the original CSA, and this one very much so in the early literature that you read, it very much talked about this idea of shared risk and shared bounty, so that the farmer didn't have to take all of the risk. And the members were encouraging of the farmers to grow a wide variety of produce, and then the members, again, would reap the rewards of all of the farmer's work. The farmer was guaranteed a certain amount of income, and the members hopefully were guaranteed a certain amount of produce. If some things did particularly well, then they would perhaps increase their increase what they reaped that particular year if something did well. Not all CSAs, I think, now really highlight the risk and the reward part, but it was definitely fundamental at the beginning.
Where did this idea come from?
Well, my understanding is that there was a young man named Jean van der Tijn, who actually is he's a U.S. citizen, but he was from Massachusetts, and he spent a lot of time in Europe as a younger man, and specifically in Switzerland. He somehow recognized there was this direct relationship between people and farms, and that there was no middle person, and that the farmers in this particular place were really benefiting from having this direct relationship. So he came back to the United States and was really seeking out a farm or some land in which he could maybe implement this idea. And I think he actually approached a couple different farms, ended up here in South Egremont, and I guess after conversing with some folks from the E.F. Schumacher Society, he was referred here to Robin Van En's farm, Indian Line Farm. And there, Robin, who was very much a visionary herself and always one to really look at how things could be more equitable for farmers and growers, really latched onto this idea. And together, the two of them with a number of other local community people, some of which just actually lived on this street, they coined the term community-supported agriculture, and they set out some of the original ideals and met actually right here in our home. And actually, you know, they wrote it all down. There's actually a notebook that exists with some of these early notes. And they decided to try it out.
That's neat. And you must feel pretty special to have the opportunity of carrying on their legacy there.
Yeah, I do. I didn't grow up on a farm, and I didn't grow up learning how to farm. I came to this later in life, and my husband and I are very much feel privileged to have ended up here and to be able to work a piece of land that we know was very much loved and cared for and stewarded.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that history with us, Elizabeth.
No problem.
You are listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We now talk to Marilyn Anderson, among the founders of Magic Beanstalk, who has carried that vision through to the present.
I think it was 1995, and we had a visioning meeting at the 4-H camp near Luther, and there were a number of people there, and we just made sticky notes and wrote all of our ideas down. And I think the original vision was to develop some sort of intentional community. But as we were doing that, we thought, well, a good way to build intentional community would be around CSA, Community Supported Agriculture. And out of that meeting, Magic Beanstalk kind of got its start. Mark Harris did it for 2 years by himself. And then we added some more producers, and they collaborated. Like 5 or 6 producers would get together in the winter and decide who was going to grow what for the CSA share. And then the 5 or 6 different producers, when the season began, would deliver that every Tuesday at the United Church of Christ, the one we still use.
Was it difficult to educate the customers about this new model of purchasing their produce?
Well, some of the early subscribers, they knew about it and they were very supportive, but it was hard to educate new people and get new members to sign on, because the idea was that they would put up money at the beginning of the season with no guarantee of getting anything. They were sharing the risk with the farmer, and that was a new idea. So yeah, it was a little bit difficult, but I think the Ames community was always quite supportive.
So Magic Beanstalk evolved. You described first one grower, then several growers, and now it is called Farm to Folk. Can you talk about that change?
Sure. I think it was 2006 when we made the change from Magic Beanstalk to Farm to Folk. And as we got bigger and the producers got so that they were more capable, a lot of them wanted to have more ownership in a CSA share that they could do at their farm. And also it was a little bit of a struggle, the communication between the growers to get the CSA share to be just right every week when they were collaborating. And so in 2006, we made Farm to Folk so that Farm to Folk would market CSA shares for several different farms. And then we also added what we call a la carte. And that is producers who don't feel up to providing a whole CSA share, but they are excellent farmers and they maybe have a special crop that they like to do. So they can offer that to the members of Farm to Folk on a week-to-week basis. So people don't commit for a whole season for the a la carte items. They just look every week at our website where we list what's available and order as they like.
So Magic Beanstalk at the beginning had how many subscribers?
I think the first couple years it was in the 20s. And then after a few years, I think the most members we had was like 122. We had just this ginormous growth spurt one year, and it was just so hard for those producers to coordinate that many CSA shares. So 122. Now at Farm to Folk, we have, I think, 284 members now, and that includes people who have CSA shares and people who actively purchase through the a la carte system.
And Farm to Folk is not just about picking up your vegetables, but it's also about educating consumers. You just had a farm cruise, is that correct?
That is correct, yeah. Three of the different producers that are involved at Farm to Folk opened their farms for a day, and we called it the farm cruise. Each farm had some vendors at their farm, but they just opened it and showed people what they do, how they grow food, how they raise grass-fed beef, lamb, goat, how they produce vegetables. So it was Tabletop Farm, the Corey Family Farm, and Berry Patch that participated.
Some young and very experienced growers.
Yeah, exactly. I think the Berry Patch has been in business for, I don't know how many years, since the 60s maybe. And Tabletop is like 3 years old. So this is the third year we've done the farm cruise, and it's increased in attendance every time. I think we had around 300 people visit the farms this time. So that was really rewarding to have that many people come out. It helped that it was like the first really nice day we had this spring.
And what kind of things did the customers say?
I think people are most struck by how much work it is that the farmers have to do. I mean, it's, you know, acres of field that has to be worked. Tabletop, we're transplanting vegetables on the day that people came out so they could really see just how much work it is. And the other thing, they just expressed appreciation that people were willing to show them what it's like to be on a farm.
Yeah, I think when we buy vegetables at Hy-Vee or our other local supermarkets, we just don't really even think about the people who have been in the fields working to make those crops possible and all of the other chain of events that got that vegetable to the supermarket.
I think that's really true. And people talk sometimes about local food being more expensive, but I think it's really important for people to see how much time and effort it takes to grow sustainably produced vegetables and meats, everything. It takes more time to not spray everything with pesticides and herbicides, and it makes a healthier product. It's worth every penny you pay for those fresh veggies that are grown locally. I think the statistic is maybe most produce has traveled 2,000 miles before it gets to your plate, and with the local food, it was often harvested the morning that you pick it up. So it's very fresh. The nutritional value is a lot higher.
Now, if you don't know what to do with it, it might sit in your refrigerator for a few days.
Yeah, I guess that's another thing we need to work on. We have in the past done some cooking classes, and I'd like to do some more of that kind of thing just so people can learn how to use things. We have a newsletter every week, and we put recipes, and if we know kale's going to be on the CSA share, we'll try and put some different recipes that tell people how to use those, maybe what are strange to them vegetables.
So you've been involved in this for many, many years, almost 20 now. And I know you as a weaver. You raise llamas your wool. Mm-hmm. And so what draws you to be so involved in the distribution of vegetables?
When I first heard about CSA, and that was before Magic Beanstalk, that was probably in the 70s, I thought it was just such a great idea, and I always wanted to do it. And I am a gardener, but I've realized that my capabilities as a gardener would never be able to produce for a CSA. But I think the idea is so important that it just keeps me at it, helping to connect producers and consumers to get the local food to people.
What about the idea especially excites you?
I think just that it's a struggle for smaller farmers to be able to make a living, especially organic farmers. And so organics is very important and exciting to me, and supporting the local economy and getting fresh, healthy food to people. All those things are exciting to me. To me, eating right is a good way to prevent a lot of health problems. So, you know, by getting a CSA share, people are kind of forced to learn how to eat healthy foods. There's a lot of things that excite me about it.
You are listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We just spoke to Marilyn Anderson of Farm to Folk, a local food buying cooperative that has developed out of the Magic Beanstalk CSA. Marilyn told me that in 2012, Farm to Folk brought in $128,000, of which 88% went straight to the growers. Now, to round off our show, let's turn to Jessica Leeds, a second-year member of Farm to Folk, who is so enthusiastic about the experience that she is volunteering for the organization this year.
Tonight we've come to volunteer because we love the organization and we love helping out and being here.
What do you love about it?
We love that it truly is a community that is committed to providing fresh produce and local, and it really does support local farmers all across this area.
So I understand that you had a share last year, and that was your first year.
Yes.
How did that go?
It went wonderful. We had heard of it a couple years before and just didn't take the time to look into it. And last year actually had a friend refer us and had nothing but good things to say about it. So we tried it out, and we just loved the feeling of opening the fridge every week and seeing that there was fresh produce and that it was local and that it was, for the most part, grown organically with organic methods.
Did you grow up eating vegetables?
I would say it was about 50-50. We liked vegetables in our home, but we didn't, I wouldn't say I grew up adoring them. As an adult, we've tried to definitely change that path with our own children, and I would say that it's worked. They truly do enjoy them.
When you were growing up, how were the vegetables served?
Mostly out of a can, but we did have some fresh vegetables. I actually grew up in northern Iowa and have moved recently. The one thing that my mom was really good about growing was simple vegetables like peppers. And so I did learn to love those, but broccoli and carrots were something that were more of an acquired taste as I got older.
You said your kids like vegetables?
My kids love vegetables, which is great. Both of my kids. I have a 6-year-old and a 2-year-old, and they adore them. My son's favorite food happens to be stir fry, which enables you to eat lots of variety of vegetables.
What's your favorite vegetable in the stir fry, bud?
Carrots.
They're kind of sweet, right?
Yeah. What else? What did we try last year that was really different? Started with a B. Bok. What? Can't remember. Bok choy. And did we like it? Yes. So one of the things that I loved the most about being part of a farm share where I'd never tried it before was we do grow our own garden at home with the things that we love. But when you come and be part of a farm share, the farm is growing a large variety of vegetables that you may not try on a regular basis. And having those in our box every week and something different to learn how to prepare and to use and to eat was a great way to introduce us to vegetables we may not have otherwise tried.
I'm going to be around my vegetables. I'm going to chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable. If you brought a big brown bag of them home,
deep well. My vegetables cart off and sell. My vegetables, I love you most of all. My favorite vegetable. I tried to kick the ball, but my tenny flew right off. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
We have Kurt Chassé here. He is the chef for the cafe.
Good morning.
Tell me about your use of local foods, locally sourced foods in your meals. How long have you been doing this?
Well, I started working with Joe Lynch from Onion Creek Farm, I'd say probably 12 years ago. Joe came to me one day, out of the blue, knocked on the front door. He had a bag of oyster mushrooms in his hand. He said, "Are you interested in these?" I said, "Absolutely." Because as chefs, we are constantly looking for high quality ingredients. Well, these mushrooms fit the bill. They were awesome, delicious, great. It started my relationship with Joe. Joe is a local farmer, I come to find out. And once the door was open for him, he asked if I'd be interested in any of these vegetables that he grew. Salad mix, peas, green beans. The quality was far superior than anything I'd been dealing with from the produce companies. So it was a no-brainer for me. Let's get more of these farmers in the door and try to utilize this local stuff. At least we can have it for our growing season here. That opened the door to other farmers with meats and other things that we could use year-round. And it's just been a snowball effect since then.
Do you think this adds to your creativity as a chef?
Without a doubt. A lot of times they have a small amount of something, so it's kind of a surprise. They'll bring in, "Oh, golly, I have 5 pounds of okra. Can you do anything with it?" Sure, we can, you know, but we have to think about it, and, you know, it gets the creative juices flowing that way. The asparagus just started rolling in. I've got a guy growing chervil for me, which I have not had in the past. Just whatever we can get, it's exciting. It's an exciting time for us.
My favorite vegetable.
People want a salad. They want a salad in December, you know? And a lot of our local guys have been using high tunnels, and they've been extending their growing season. So we were fortunate enough to have lettuce locally all winter long from the berry patch. So it's moving in the right direction as far as I'm concerned. I think it's the most critical thing right now that we could do. We need community gardens. We need people thinking on a local basis, you know, to get their food. I mean, what is more important than food? You need food to live. It should be on the top of our list. We have to figure this out.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. My guests have been Margaret Vance of Ames Historical Society, Tom Sveck, formerly of Ames Fruit and Produce, Judy Henry of Berry Patch Farm, Bruce Smith of Iowa Fresh Produce, Mark Harris, Elizabeth Keene of Indian Line Farm, Marilyn Anderson and Jessica Leeds of Farm to Folk, and Kurt Chassé, chef at the cafe. Thanks also to Joe Lynch and Lana Noctegal of Onion Creek Farm for their contributions, Sarah Hegland for her research and discussions, and Rick Morrison for sound effects. Richard Morrison engineered the show. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. That recording by the Beach Boys, Brian Wilson and Al Jardine, included a guest performance by Paul McCartney, chomping on raw vegetables for percussion. You can download this show and find contact information for our guests at the KHOI website, khoifm.org. Go to the Shows tab and look for Local Talk. Your participation as audience is what makes our work worthwhile. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends or join the KHOI community as a member. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.